The WLEW, News and Public Affairs Department, now presents What Do You Think? Here's your host, Craig Routson, with today's topic.
Good morning. It is currently about 9 minutes past the hour of 10 o'clock here at the station, and I've got several guests in the studio today for the program. Sheriff Kelly Hansen.
Hi, Craig.
We have the Undersheriff, Sheriff Miller, and we also have Marine Patrol Officer Dave. Is it Navok or Navok?
Navok.
Okay, and we're going to be talking first about the upcoming Marine season. It is Safe Boating Week nationally, so good time to get that into everybody's head, to get out on the water and do it right. And I guess first thing I'd ask is, we're getting off to a late season this year because people I've been talking to say they haven't even put their boats in the water yet because it's been kind of cold.
Well, the Port Austin area, the harbor is somewhat tied up, so there's not been a lot of activity out in the Port Austin area, but there has been activity out of Caseville. And granted, it has been that long ago either since the ice actually left, so I guess you could kind of gauge it that way, but there is boating activity. I was down in Sebring the other night. I seen a couple of trailers that were boats were out in the water, and we actually put all of our fleet in the water. Dave and Lieutenant Weisenbaugh put our bigger boats in the water on Monday, so we're all set and ready to go.
Where do you keep your boats? I understand you kind of don't do Harbor Beach because the Coast Guard is right there, and you try and spread them around the rest of the thumb to keep down travel times if anything happens?
Correct. There's a 22-foot boat in the Sebring Harbor, a 26-foot boat in the Caseville Harbor, and a 31-foot boat in Port Austin.
Is that because the bigger lake brings bigger waves and you need the bigger boat most likely up there?
That's the way we've always kind of gauged it, and we just put our best resource up there, and there's an awful lot of area to cover if we had to respond further into or down our eastern shoreline as opposed to on our western side where we're there's water, but not as open of water as what there is on our east side.
You also have other vessels, though, some that you trailer, like the airboat and stuff, that can get you into places where the bigger boats can't go.
Right. The airboat sits at the Caseville Fire Hall, and there's a 14-foot Boston Whaler that we've had since 1967 that is a standby boat for shallow activities or any unfortunate situation that's come in handy during drownings.
Yeah, we don't want to think about that. We've been very lucky the last few years.
Big time in comparison to when I first started working at the sheriff's office in the early 80s, it wasn't uncommon to have 4 or 5 drownings per year. And it's been a couple of years now since we've actually, I take that back, we were down in Tuscola County last year during the ice season recovering a victim 5 miles offshore, but we've been lucky up here that it's been a couple of years since there's been anybody lose their life by drowning.
Is a lot of that education and patrolling and being out there? I know Dave is out there on the boats. They're not just called out when there's an emergency and the boats don't sit there for 3 months waiting for one. They're out there patrolling, they're out there seeing what's going on to you know, people slow down when they see a police car on the road. They probably boat a little safer when they see you guys around.
I'd let Dwayne answer that question, but I can tell you, like last year, we had 2 recoveries. I and members of the Port Austin Fire Department pulled a individual out of the water. It would have been a Memorial Day weekend. That had capsized a kayak and became hypothermic, couldn't get him out of the water, and we did that along with the airboat crew of Kaler and Willenberg got a lady out of the water a couple weeks prior to that. The cold, I looked at the water temperatures today along our shoreline, and they're in the mid-40s to getting real close in the Caseville area to near 50 along the shoreline there. But that's hypothermic is a little different, or somebody losing their life to hypothermia isn't considered a drowning in those regards, but still can take a life. Now, as far as You know, what do we believe there isn't the amount of drownings? I'm going to let Dwayne answer that one.
A lot of that has to do with modern electronics, and people are getting better about knowing how to use them and knowing where they're at and being more aware of their surroundings and things like that.
Do people get a false sense of security taking their cell phone with them because they may not hit a tower?
Yeah, they're not real reliable. They're good for talking to your buddies, but when you get in trouble, especially if you had a carrier from down in the city or something like that, they don't work that well. The best thing you can do is the newer marine radios that are out have the DSC compatible, and the Coast Guard has a Rescue 21 system where when that new style of marine radio is hooked up with a GPS, you push one button and it automatically puts your position out of where you're at. And with the bigger boats, we're not having so much of a problem anymore, but kayaks and non-motorized seem to be a lot more of our complaints lately, where whether it's somebody coming up from the city and they're not, you know, they may do an inland lake, they're not used to being on the big lake and getting in trouble pretty quick.
Now, do you find like people in kayaks where they're more likely to get into the water aren't dressing appropriately for this water temperature? When you go out into 50 degree air temperature, a light jacket might be fine. But as I understand it, water drains your heat a whole lot faster than cold air will.
Right. And the other thing is, you know, they might go in their local sporting store and buy one and not really know how to, if it flips over, how to right themselves when they're up in the water and they're not able to get back in it. And everything just escalates from there.
So they need a little more training maybe before they go out, especially on the big lake.
Right.
Is that part of the problem? The big lake is, enticing, but it makes it much more dangerous when you can go out so far you can't see shore.
And when you got like in Port Austin, you got a lighthouse 2.5 miles offshore, and people want to get close to see it. A kayak's not really unless you're experienced in using a kayak. That's probably not the best trip you want to take.
And that lake can churn up pretty quick, can't it?
Yes, it can.
Just a little shift in the wind, and all of a sudden, it's on shore and those things are breaking and coming in at you.
And if you're in something like a light kayak, the wind's going to push you pretty easy.
Now, do we have that same kind of problem when they go to the beach and they're in like inner tubes and stuff and they float out too far and their feet can't touch and they can't get themselves pushed back into shore?
Over the years, I've had several complaints exactly like that, whether it's a inflatable mattress or a small inflatable boat. But lately, I haven't heard of any of them in quite a few years, but that used to happen quite often.
It's been a while. I don't know about Dave. Dave's out on the water. Have you run into that in the past? The swim toys floating, or people on the swim floaties floating away from shore?
Yeah, we had a couple last year, Oak Beachway, and also people calling in thinking that people are in distress. I know we had one right by McGraw Park where we actually got them on our boat and took them back to shore, and then we had one over by Oak Beach where we got contacted about someone that looked like they were in distress and had drifted out further than they should have been.
It wasn't uncommon back during the busy times or better times where there were boats out on the water, though, on a regular weekend, to come across stuff like that with a southwesterly breeze or a southerly breeze, people being overtaken by the wind or the breeze and not being able to get back in.
I'm not going to speak for you, but I would think you would want people to err on the side of caution and call in if they think somebody is having a problem, as opposed to not. Because I read a report that you guys had handled where they thought there might be somebody, a boat that was in the water, and ended up in the report, it sounded like he was fishing next to a buoy, and that was the thing bobbing in the water. But at least somebody was concerned enough to let your people know what was going on.
You're probably referring to a couple of weeks ago on a Sunday night, maybe?
Could be.
It was off the Sand Point area, and that was right at dusk. And the complainant had been watching and described what he saw. As cold as, and there was supposed to be an individual there, or it appeared to be an individual in the water. We had a road deputy go and try and verify what he was seeing, but it was also at dusk. The water's cold, and we got the airboat moving real quick and got out there. Fortunately, there wasn't nobody out there, but people do call, and we certainly wouldn't want to discourage them from calling.
Because the one time it is an emergency, you want to be told.
And the other, if it's something they think don't wait till dusk. That's, from my standpoint of doing this for several years, the most frustrating thing is if you can get at it before it starts to get dark, that improves everybody's odds that much more. When you, on a sunny day, it's like finding a needle in a haystack. You add darkness to that, and that just compounds everything. And so if you have a chance to call before it gets dark, or you know, when you think something's not right, go ahead and call. We don't have a problem checking that out.
You also get calls. I've been here long enough to see that they've come in from, they see lights across the bay and they think there's somebody out there in trouble. And but again, you check it out and you make sure nobody's in trouble, because you would not want to ever think you left anybody out there to fight it alone.
Or the military jets dropping flares. That used to be really big too, but that doesn't happen as much anymore. So
Wordsmith Air Force Base, when it was in operation, there were several nights back in the 80s, I can tell you, that I ended back up out on a boat trying to figure out what light somebody may have saw. And it could have been landing aircraft at Oscoda or what have you. And fortunately, people wouldn't be missing the following morning. So that's a lot of times how we close it out.
Now, safety is the number one thing. Are people wearing their life jackets? We have laws for the people to wear their seat belts. There are laws for wearing the life vests for kids of certain age, but are people following this, or do you find it out in the water there? Are they adhering to what they're supposed to do?
Well, nowadays with the inflatable life jackets, they're getting a lot more popular. Fishermen tend to wear those more often. With children, parents have been pretty good about making sure their kids six and under are in a life jacket. And a lot of them even go past the law. I mean, their parents enforce it and make them wear a life jacket past that. The thing to watch with the children life jackets, though, is toy companies putting out a product to try to make money. It's not necessarily a Coast Guard approved life jacket. You need to check inside of it when you go to buy a life jacket and make sure there's the U.S. Coast Guard approved stamp in there. Then you know it's made to hold you up long term, keep your head out of the water if you were to.
The important part, keep your head out of the water. I know when I was younger, we would water ski and we had the little rings that went around your
ski
waist.
Belt.
The old ski belt.
Ski belt. And, you know, as long as you were conscious, you could stay above the water. But if you just let yourself go, that belt tried to come to the surface, you were on your back and your head could go under. So they kind of went out of fashion. But you do need to know what you're strapping your kids into. And you mentioned the inflatables. Is that something fishermen should watch out for? It seems like you could stick a hook through something, and when you go to use it, it's just leaking out on you.
With any life jacket, how you store them and how they are accessible are important. I mean, you don't want to throw them in with your tackle necessarily, but we actually bought some inflatables this year, and they're rather durable on the outside, so and they don't actually expand until they're triggered, so it'd be tough to, possible, but it'd be tough to damage them by just maybe getting a hook in the outer shell.
You'd have to work at puncturing that life jacket as opposed to by accident.
But there's an importance statement in there. You have to take care of them.
Yep.
I mean, people tend to throw them in almost into the bilge with the oily water and everything else that might accumulate from the motor, and all of this stuff is hard on the plastics, the rubber, and any coating on top that would to seal it off.
Or used as a dock bumper or seat.
One like that is pretty ripped up and covered in oil, and the guy told me that was his mother-in-law's life jacket.
Oh, wow. Is there an age limit on them? Do they have an expiration date, or is it basically a visual check that you guys make that it looks good, the ties are strong, everything else is there that's going to be there when you need it?
As we're doing your safety inspection down at the dock, we're going to look over each life jacket and make sure. But things you can look in your own life jacket is if it's tore, if the straps are starting to dry rot. If you pull on it, you can tell something's dry rotted. If it's starting to crack or any tears in it, it's not going to work right, so you need to cut it up completely, throw it out, and replace it.
And they need to be sized for the person who's using it. I mean, you know, you can't say I've got life jackets and you've got kids on board and they're all the big ones, because they'll slip right out of them. They're not designed for a kid.
Right. Even smaller adults, some may not fit, so you need to make sure you have one that's sized correctly for each person on board.
Are there things required to have on your boat? You're talking about the safety checks. I'm sure you, after the life jackets, you do other things in there. Do you need a horn? Do you need lights? Do you need, because some boats are, are smaller. You get to the fishing boats, they aren't necessarily going to have a battery or anything else for lights. And is there certain requirements that they do need to meet, or is that based on what type of boat they are?
Well, it's based on size. And when you get into the smaller boats, some of it's based on motor or not motor. There's no the type of power on it. The large thing to watch for, I saw last year at least, is 16 foot and over need a throw ring or cushion on it. You see, we've seen quite a few of them as of late without a throw ring PFD. That's one thing you need to check.
That's a personal flotation device, but you shouldn't really use the seat cushion as your personal one. You can use it as in an emergency to throw to somebody to help keep them up till you can get there, but I would think sitting on it and all of that would be about the hardest thing you'd do to it.
Well, your throw ring's in addition to one wearable for each
person.
That's just an extra in case someone does go overboard.
I was a kid and you went fishing, they were the little seat pads, and those were called your life preservers, and it's like, yeah, but you're not wearing it, and you got to be able to grab it. If you're unconscious, you're not going to grab it. So.
Actually, last year throughout the season, the Marine Division did. You spoke. You were speaking of the safety inspections. We did 430 of them, and of those 430, we'll issue a sticker if they complete the inspection satisfactory, to where we won't inspect them again. But that sticker doesn't get given out on every inspection because they do honestly look at the safety equipment that is on board.
Now, you mentioned the throw ring. Do you need a rope so you can bring them back? Is that required, or does that take till you get to a certain size vessel?
It's not required by law, but it's a good idea, because if you throw it once and miss, what are you going to do?
Well, and if they're having trouble swimming to begin with, it'd be easier for you to pull them toward you than to force them to try and make it there, especially against the wind or the current or the waves and everything else.
That's probably the best thing you can do, besides taking a safe boarding class, is if you see the Marine officers down by the marina when you're getting ready to launch, they're not coming up and asking you for an inspection, ask them. Over the years, there's been a lot of potential serious problems I found doing them. Cut hoses or gas in the bilge, or forgetting to put the bilge plug in, things like that. And we share a lot of information, too. Not always, but we might even tell you where the fish are biting. Sometimes we're sworn to secrecy, but we'll if you're nice, we're nice, and we might help you out on that, too.
Well, last year, they issued four citations in the Marine Division, and one of those was for not wearing a life jacket, but there were five warnings given during the inspection process, along with not having the right amount of life jackets on there. I think there was 20 warnings, or the right type, I'm sorry, of life jacket. Another thing that's is big during these inspections is not having flares that are in date. Looks like we give 59 warnings during these inspections last year.
They're just, you bolt them onto your vessel somewhere and you kind of forget about them because you don't use them every day, and you know they're there for an emergency, but they get old like anything else. And again, you want them to be usable when you need them. And are they certain types of flares you need? Are they special types of flares? I mean, you just can't take a road flare or something, or because you're going to want something that either shoots up and gives you a better vantage point or doesn't burn your hand while you're trying to hold it.
Right. Well, it's the U.S. Coast Guard approved stamp on them once again. The orange one will be a daytime distress only. So if you're going to buy them, the red type flare would be a day or nighttime distress. When you're looking in the stores for your flares, they should expire every 3 years. So when you pick them up off the shelf, make sure you get your 3 years you're paying for off of them. If not, I'd look for a different package.
Go to the back of the bin so they haven't put the oldest ones up front to sell them off.
And if you have some still on your boat that are in good condition, the handheld ones, they'll get wet and they'll swell up and you can tell they're not good, but if they look like they're still in good condition, save them. Get your three new ones so you're compliant with the law. Save your old ones. If you get in trouble, you got that many more to use.
Because you're only as safe as how well you can be seen.
Yep. And another thing, going back to talking about cell phones, is if you have a cell phone and your cell phone's not working and you don't have any flares, or you only have three flares, how are you going to tell anybody you're in trouble? If you have a Marine radio You can find out other people in the area that are in trouble, help them out, or you can get a hold of the Coast Guard and let them know you're in trouble, or a sheriff's patrol boat, or whatever. But
and most phones don't work after you get them wet.
That's true,
too. For quite a while. Even, and sometimes never. Sometimes it just destroys them. And so, you know, maybe put it in a plastic bag even just so you get back to shore and you know it's going to work even without an incident. But they're not that reliable in the water.
And in the past, people have been over on the lake and dialed 911 and end up getting Canada. For whatever reason, they would grab a tower out of Canada, and that's extra time that's wasted by the time they figure out where the call needs to go or the other side of the bay.
I know 911 here gets calls from Aranac County all the time. It just hits our towers and away it goes.
One of the pieces of technology that wasn't available back in my so-called day in the 80s is if they're using that cell phone to call dispatch, they're actually able to triangulate where, maybe that's not the word to use, triangulate, they're picking up the, they're able to come up with the coordinates of where that phone's coming from. So that certainly helps when it comes time for search and rescue. Last year we recovered 15 boats and that had 29 people total with on the 15 boats, along with had 44 different complaints that we handled and handled two accidents throughout the season. We spent almost 65 hours working on those search and rescues, which would have been a heck of a lot more if we didn't have that technology that's available today where people were using their cell phone to call dispatch.
We were talking about the flares expiring. What about fire extinguishers? When you get to a boat with a motor, usually you'd like to have some way to stop it from burning. They need to be a certain type. They need to be able to take a gas fire or diesel, whatever you're running. Because the last thing you want to be is stuck in a boat in the middle of the lake. That's burning.
Right, and on the side of the fire extinguisher, it'll tell you what size you have, the B1, the B2, and the marine ones are typically have a U.S. Coast Guard stamp on them also. A lot of them come with a gauge now within glass. If not, to test your fire extinguisher at the beginning of the year, we show a lot of people how to test them when we're doing our safety inspections. But make sure your yellow pin's pushed in, and then you're going to want to push down on your top button of your fire extinguisher. If it pops back up, you know it's good. If that stays pushed down, depressed, then it's time to go to a new fire extinguisher and replace that one.
Check the nozzle too. A lot of times over the winter, mud daubers and spiders like to build nests in there.
So you're shooting spiders the first thing.
Found quite a few of those.
And from what I understand from talking to people in the fire departments, you shoot for the base of the fire, not the flames. Because the flames are just the afterthought of what goes.
Correct.
You want to go for where the source is.
Yep. First thing you want to do is get your bow or whatever pointed upwind so you don't have the smoke blowing on you. There's different theories on what you should do next. If you have other people, you should do a drill or just talk back and forth. What are we going to do if something like this happens? So, you know, somebody's going to be calling for help. Because on a fiberglass boat or a small boat, you're not going to have a whole lot of time. Matter of fact, on jet skis, I recommend you never ride alone. If you have a fire, you know, how do you get it? Usually the fire extinguisher is stored underneath the seat and the engine's underneath the seat and the fire is going to be at the engine, so your best bet is just to jump off. And if you're riding with somebody else, you know, get on with them and get away from it. But if you're on a small boat and it catches on fire, somebody should be calling for help while somebody else is trying to put the fire out or stop it or
Seems like the jet skis, you know where it's going to be.
Yep.
It seems like, you know, almost in design, they should put a fire suppression system in. You just put the fire extinguisher in there, and if it's triggered, it's triggered, and puts it out. I mean, you know, maybe I've got a $1 million idea.
There you go.
Should patent it. You have a fire extinguisher. What else do you need on a boat? Is there other things that should be there that maybe people don't think of? The navigation lights at night, people... You know, they have the red and the green on the front and the white in the back. At least that was when I was a kid boating. That's what you had. But is that changed? Is there other things that you need to have?
No, that's still correct. A thing that we find on the inboard motors a lot of times is the back flame arrestor not being cleaned properly or automotive product in there, which isn't made for the boats. These back flame arresters are the air filter looking thing on the top of your motor, and they're made if your motor backfires, contain the sparks and the flames within it. And if it's dirty or an automotive product, that's where a lot of boat fires actually start. So,
and a lot of explosions at the beginning when you're starting an engine, because if you don't properly use your fan to vent the bilge out of any built-up gases, that spark arrestor could be a lifesaver.
You must have did a lot of boating, Craig. I'm impressed.
Well, you know, I lived through it, so I knew what to do. But you do need that fan, and you do need to run it properly before you go. It's all part of the, it's like NASA getting ready for a launch. You just have to do these things to make sure you leave the dock safe.
In a thing at the harbors here, especially on a busy day, it's appreciated that you get your boat ready prior to getting down to the dock and then start putting up your canopy and stuff. It's better to kind of do that in the parking lot to keep the line moving there, because anybody who's boated on a Saturday in June when it's nice, they know how backed up and get there.
Dwayne did a few statistics on when the worst day to boat. If you'd like to go over that one.
Do they fall on holiday weekends? Because they are the busiest, usually.
Not necessarily. And this information is from the same thing you had on one of your news stories, where you could get the Coast Guard boating safety statistics from 2013. And it's where this information comes from, and they'll break it down to the type of boat and type of day and the type of weather and everything from compiled boating accidents throughout the United States. Generally, the water conditions are calm, waves less than 6 inches. The wind is light, 0 to 6 miles an hour. The visibility is good. Water temperature is 70 to 79 degrees. The time of day is 2:31 p.m. through 4:30 p.m. The month is July. Day of the week is Saturday. The hull material of the boat is a fiberglass. The horsepower is 76 through 150 horsepower. The year of the boat is prior to 2000, and the length is 16 to 26 feet. So 16 to 26 feet is generally, or actually 0 to 26 feet is the most common registered boat in the United States. That's your general fishing boat. And the statistics are showing it's not the rough, nasty thunderstorms where a lot of these accidents are happening. Most of them are happening on nice, calm days. On Saturdays in July.
Do they say what the problem was? Was it overturning? Was it colliding with another boat? Was it a wake from a freighter going by? I mean, something had to happen.
The primary cause or contributing factor of accidents is operator inattention, not paying attention.
One hand on the wheel, the other on a beer?
And the primary causing of fatal accidents or deaths is alcohol use.
Granted, these are all statistics that kind of paint a picture.
But people shouldn't feel necessarily overconfident because it's nice out there. That's when a lot of things happen.
Common. Yes, you're right.
Are the laws on the water pretty much in place with the laws on the road as far as drinking, driving, rules of the road type of stuff?
The only difference would be that on the road, the legal limit is 0.08, and on the water, it's still 0.10. There's been talk quite a few years on changing that to bring it down to 0.08, but as of right now, it's still at 0.10.
Is that something when you're on patrol you normally can check, or is that something it's more suspected after the problem happens? Because do you carry a PBT aboard? Can you actually do that stuff? You're a full deputy. You can redo the roads, not just part-time for the summers and the Marine Patrol. You can do all of this stuff. Do you do that out on the water?
Well, a lot of all of our Marine guys can execute OWI arrests on the water.
Oh, really?
They go up to a school, and any of them, all of us can do it. But in the past few years, the most we've ran into is on boating accidents and making an arrest for boating while intoxicated from that. So,
on the road, you can see they're not staying between the lines. On the water, it's a little more difficult to see the patterns.
Usually run into them when it's too late. One of the arrests that I was involved in was up in the Grindstone area, where it was either four or five people on a 14 or 15 foot rowboat, a good stiff southwesterly breeze. They flipped the boat over. Everybody's in the water. We along with the Coast Guard are sent up there. A person on the shoreline responds, gets, we all get there at the same time and get the people out of the water. And came down to operating under the influence is what it came down to, which an arrest was made. Like we just said, or like we're talking about, when we run into this, it's normally when an accident has occurred. And it doesn't happen often, but it does happen probably too much.
How important is it for people to let people on shore know where they're going, when they're coming back? I know a lot of times you folks get the calls when people are way inland and they say my husband or my father didn't come back. He was supposed to be back, you know, but they had an idea where they were going. Does that give you a good starting point? At least you see the car and the trailer is there. Not everybody takes off from their cottage in front of it.
Float plans is basically what they are, where you tell somebody where you're going, what time you expect to be back, and if I'm not back by a certain time, who to call, and what type of vehicle and boat I have, and who's with me. And you don't see that as much anymore because people are carrying cell phones. They're depending on that, and it's hard
to explain, though, that feeling when you just get that initial information and you pull to the ramp where they were supposed to have launched out of, and you see that lone vehicle sitting there. And then decide how you're going to what the next step is going to be, because over the years there have been years ago, especially out of the Caseville area, people would go to Charity Island and spend the night there, or they would get blown onto the island and couldn't get back to Caseville. There was no cellular service, didn't know what the real situation was, and we would find ourselves going out there to find that out. But when you see that lone vehicle sitting there, it's like hopefully that tragedy hasn't already occurred.
And if it has, you don't know if it happened almost immediately as they got out there or at the end of their day, which accounts for how much drifting they could do or how the waves are going. And you have to try and plot all of this stuff out to figure out if it may have happened here, they'd be here by now, and try and make your search pattern work. And there's a lot of guesswork in that, and the more information you have, the less guesswork you have to deal with.
Back one complaint or incident that sticks out in my mind, back to the 80s we go, a 14-foot or 16-foot rowboat was rented out of the Grindstone area on a Friday night, and it was determined on a Sunday night, it was Labor Day weekend, that in the evening that the people were missing. Apparently they just got overlooked. Well, that search started and went through the whole night of rough water. We had had storms come through. The water turned rough, and the Coast Guard was able to locate them off of Sleeper State Park, 5 or 6 miles. And they were they had spent, if I recall, almost 8 hours in the water because of the changing conditions of that Sunday, turning into that Monday morning when they were finally found. And they had nothing but those sea cushion life jackets, and they clung to this overturned rowboat. And how it all shook out, they actually were blowing through it with southwesterly breezes many miles out into the open water of Lake Huron, and then eventually got pushed over off of the as time had went on. They had broke down on Friday night, shortly after renting the boat. They had broke down, didn't have enough anchor line in that deep water that was there, and just drifted that night, drifted all day Saturday, getting blown back and forth till they were finally picked out of the water off of Sleeper State Park, many miles away.
An important thing in what you just went through there, stick with the boat. Unless you're touching the bottom of this, when you're standing next to the boat, unless you're touching and you can see shores just 30 feet away, stick with the boat.
Yep.
It's a big thing for you folks to see, as opposed to just a head bobbing in the water with dark hair and low light conditions to begin with. And it's just better for you if you've got something you can crawl out onto if it gets a little too cold.
And we've got some newer technology on our patrol boats too. One, our big boat's got a FLIR system, which picks up heat signatures, and like the bow of a boat sticking out of the water, it's going to pick that up a lot quicker than it's going to pick somebody's head bobbing in the water. So if you're sticking with the boat, staying on there as good as you can, then we're in the area, that FLIR system will pick that up a lot quicker than just a little speck of the head sticking out of the water.
It sure has changed a lot since, I'm sure, when you started. Yep. All the technology out there, all the things. You mentioned safe boating classes. Has that changed through the years? I mean, when I took one way back when, you know, the olden days of sailing ships and stuff, you know, we had to go through the whole thing about, you know, charting from compass to magnetic and true course. Has all that changed with GPS and all this stuff where you just have the computer on board plot you a course?
Basics are still the same. Unfortunately, GPSs are unbelievable, accurate, but a lot of people don't know how to use them. They'll have them on their boats, I've had phone calls from people off of Seabling wanting me to come out and pick them up because it's rough and they had a brand new GPS and didn't know how to use it.
And you can't necessarily rely on water depth charts anymore these days. They were down for a few years here, really low, picking up a little bit, but still below average. And things pop up in the water. I mean, it's an ongoing, evolving thing. You know, you can have a chart, and 3 days later,
somebody could have
a wreck out there. And
to the crash statistics where it says operator inattention, you have to have a lookout, and you have to know what you're coming up against, or if something's in the water, or depth changes, or
You see a seagull that looks like it's standing on something. It's not something to dive at for fun and games. There's probably a sunken object. Back to the water depths. As of yesterday, what were we? 11 Lake Huron's 11 inches
since,
over.
Since ice out, we're up 11 inches above chart datum.
Better news for water depths, and that'll continue to climb through July before it starts to recede. So it could very well be. Could very well be close to 20 inches, and that's just my words or predictions. Could be a lot of water could return to the lakes.
But people shouldn't drop their guard either. I don't know how many times I've heard people, they went out from Caseville and they turned that corner just too soon where the point ends and don't realize that point is still going on under the water for a ways and take out their stern drive or their propeller or whatever and have to be towed back in. So just because it's up a little bit, no need to drop your caution about those things.
Or where the shore, or where the land comes to a drastic point anywhere, that's a signature of a shoal somewhere, sir.
It's still going out under the water for a ways. Yep. And usually it's rocks because the sand will move.
And not to mention the logs or anything else after a big rain, it'll be floating around.
And you have an accident. It's still the owner's responsibility to get that boat out and make sure there's no ecological damage, all that kind of stuff?
Right. A lot of times we end up getting a call for an accident by the time they're at the hospital. I mean, you still, if you have damage to your vessel, upwards of $1,000, you need, which anymore on a boat, it doesn't take much to get to $1,000. You need to report that accident, and we seem to get a lot of our accident calls by the time they're at Sure Hospital or here on Medical Center, then we're starting to investigate them, so we're behind.
And then and as far as the responsibility of the the gasoline or the oil in the water there, that falls back onto the vessel owner.
As I know, when you've had people in the past drop four-wheel drives through the ice, you know, the four-wheel ATVs, they had to pluck them out.
Yep.
They just, you can't make it, you know, an artificial reef or something. It's got to come out because there's contaminants in it, and it needs to be taken care of. And
I don't know where the line is actually drawn, but if it's known where it's at, I'm sure there's recourse that would make you remove it.
And there are salvage firms out there that can help people out with it. It's not a personal thing that you have to get a friend with a boat to do it. There are salvage people out there who know what they're doing and can make sure it's done properly and can sign the paperwork so the DEQ and that is all happy.
And a lot of the boats that are built with to the level flotation standard, they're not going to generally go to the bottom. So, yeah, I'm sure it's going to cost you a little bit to have a salvage company take care of it. If you got insurance, Boat US insurance is pretty cheap, considering what the penalties are, what it could cost if you didn't have the insurance to get out. And you can even check with your homeowner's insurance to see if it covers it. Sometimes it covers it, too. So it wouldn't necessarily be that a diver has to dive down and recover it from the bottom. The bow or something should be floating enough to where they could move it to shore and pump it out and go from there.
And again, it's a navigation hazard you're responsible for until somebody plucks it out of the water. Because when people go to sue, they go to whoever's property it was.
Exactly.
We were going to talk a little bit about some of the other things going on in the Thumb, but we, you know, kind of filled up our time here with the voting. If people want a check of their boat, holiday weekends, I'm sure you're going to be around there. If you see the guys around the Sheriff's Department boats, you can ask and they'll come over.
Right. We'll have guys all weekend on the west side of the county and also up in Port Austin all the way through Memorial Day. Then every weekend throughout the summer we'll be around too. So hopefully the guys are out checking boats, and if not, you can flag them down. They'll either be in the parking lot doing those checks or out on the water, which we can do them at either. Or on a rougher day, it's a little tougher to do the checks in the water, but we'll take care of you either way. So.
And it's all pretty much voluntary unless you see they're doing something totally illegal, and then when you get there, you can do a safety check. How does that work?
If they're in the water, it's state law that you must submit to it.
You must submit.
Once you pass and you get that sticker, then you're good for the summer. Our policy has always been, if we do them in the parking lot and there's something wrong or you're missing something, we're not going to write you a ticket for it. We'll give you a chance to correct it, do whatever you need to do, take care of the problem. We're not out to ruin anybody's day or be badge heavy and lay down a bunch of tickets or stuff like that. If we can help you out and get you pointed in the right direction, that's what we're trying to do.
There was 193 warnings that were given throughout the whole year, mostly related to doing those safety inspections. And like I said earlier, there was only four tickets under the grand scheme of all summer long, which I consider pretty good. We see some good compliance. So getting a hold of, even calling the sheriff's office and making arrangements, if they live on the shoreline, people live on the shoreline, we'll stop by. We're pretty fortunate. The state, this is the administrative side of me. I'm not particularly happy with the funding that the state is allowing our county, because there are other counties of similar size. We have a lot of a shoreline of water. I mean, we've got 93 miles of shoreline that some counties with less, and we have a big concentration of registered boats in our county or using our shoreline, but we're only allowed $16,000 a year from the state, where back in the day we would have been up in the into the 60s. Fortunately, the commissioners see the need and supplement that $16,000 with another $16,000 or close to it, to where we can function the whole summer long, particularly on the weekends there.
Well, a good reputation is also what brings the tourists. People don't want to go someplace they think is dangerous. They want to know they're going to be well cared for when they're here. Well, I appreciate you coming out today. I hope you have a safe season. I hope you don't have any rescues that require, you know, anything, you know, like drownings or anything. I hope we have another good year and we can put another one in the books that says it isn't going to happen. I hope I didn't jinx it.
Well, we're in comparison to the 83 counties in our state, we're equipped very well. There's knowledgeable operators. We're not flawless, though, we're dedicated. We're gonna do our best. I can guarantee you that. You were at a presentation yesterday of a trailer that we keep our dive equipment in. We're one of very few counties in the state of Michigan that are capable of doing the things that. Of ice diving and other recovery. We're equipped, and there's dedication. We can't be everywhere at once, and we're taking a pledge to do our best.
Is the rules of the water the same as the road? Your lights go on, you have to stop.
Sure.
That type of thing. I mean, it's not an option. It's not, you know, well, it's, they're not going into the Johnny Depp Caribbean. It's more of a guideline than a rule. But you do have to stop and do it right away.
Right, and that's like the undersheriff talked about, the safety inspections on the water. That's not an optional deal like some of the other.
And the water is the dock.
Right.
I mean, people don't think that, but yep. You know, you're in the water at the dock.
Yep.
If you're floating.
And basically, we're out there to help educate and help the boaters out to know what they need. And if they approach us or we can take care of it in the parking lot, that's even better. It's easier for everybody. So.
and check the forecast before you go out. It can change quickly.
We should have talked about that right off the bat, but that's kind of a given anymore with the cell phone technology. You know, you used to have to listen for those reports on the marine radio of a storm report. Now on a smartphone, iPhone, what have you, you can look at a live radar.
Again, you're relying on technology that may not connect when you need it.
So. When it comes over marine radio directly from the National Weather Service, I believe that a lot more than an app that I'm not sure is going to work or not.
If you have to stretch the screen out to see what timestamp is on it, so you know you haven't got something that's 3 hours old.
And I'd recommend, he brings up a good point. I always use data from, I do a weather briefing every morning. I always use data from the National Weather Service, and you can actually get weather observations. There's one buoy 30 miles offshore that's not been installed yet that'll give wave heights, and there's a buoy that'll be just to the south of or right around the gravelly shoal lights that'll give wave heights also. So there's some of that data you can get, but using the National Weather Service, I recommend their products for getting an accurate forecast.
Like anything you search on the internet, it's the reliability of the source. You can find anything on there, and some things you shouldn't find. Thanks for being with us. I hope we have a safe boating season, and you guys are going to be out there in full force this weekend, so people can wave and be friendly. It doesn't mean you're going to get stopped.
Looks like a nice weekend too, Craig.
It's shaping up to be,
yep.
So we'll see what we can see. Our guests today on the program have been Sheriff Kelly Hansen, Under Sheriff Dwayne Miller, and Deputy Dave Navak. He's with the Marine Patrol. He also does road patrol other times of the year. And again, the boating season in earnest will start this weekend, so do be careful out on the water. Coming up at the top of the hour, we will clue you in on all the latest in the news.